Welcome to Onk Live On Air. I'm your host today, Ashling Wehner. In today's episode, we had the pleasure of speaking with Nicole LaManna, MD, about patient selection considerations for the use of pirtobrutinib in the management of chronic lymphocytic leukemia. In our exclusive interview, Dr. LaManna discussed how disease progression, treatment intolerance, and prior therapy exposure informed the decision to initiate pirtobrutinib in patients with CLL. She also highlighted important clinical features that guide the use of non-covalent BTK inhibitors, including sequencing strategies following covalent BTK and BCL2 inhibitors, and emphasized the importance of balancing treatment efficacy with tolerability to optimize long-term disease management in CLL.
How do you determine which patients with CLL are eligible for pirtobrutinib, and you know what patient characteristics or disease features might help inform that decision?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so, you know, pirtobrutinib is one of the newer tools we have in our toolbox now to treat CLL. And it's a non-covalent BTK inhibitor, which is different than, you know, obviously what we currently have, right? So we have the covalent BTK inhibitors are brutinib, acalabrutinib, and zanubrutinib. But obviously the non-covalent BTK inhibitors are reversible binders to BTK, to the target. And so one of the advantages of that is that clearly when we think about patients, and again, part of this is how these drugs have just gotten approved, right? So we had covalent BTK inhibitors approved first, and then we had our first BCL2 inhibitor with venetoclax approved. And now, you know, pirtobrutinib was the first non-covalent BTK inhibitor approved. And so in sequencing, it is currently approved in mostly in really third line, right? So people who have failed a covalent BTK inhibitor, failed some sort of BCL2 combination, although there is a little bit of data, obviously, for patients who are intolerant to covalent BTK inhibitors. So certainly you can do it in an intolerant situation as well. But typically the way the data has been with the Bruin study for pirtobrutinib has been mostly in patients who are either refractory or double refractory to both the covalent and a BCL2 inhibitor. And so that's more or less how I tend to use the drug still currently. Is that I tend to do it in patients who are refractory to covalent or to a BCL2 combination. And that's most of the patients that you can think about now that it's FDA approved. That's most of the patients then you can offer it in that setting. Typically, we're still looking at, when we think about patients who are relapsed, we're still using the same indications that we used, whether it's frontline or relapse. In other words, that patients are needing therapy because they're developing, you know, cytopenias, or they're developing progressive bulky adenopathy again, you know, and so we're still looking for indications to treat. We're not necessarily, you know, jumping from one to another without having a reason. And I think this comes up, you know, even when we think about other drugs, when I think a common question I always get is, well, what about if they're on a covalent BTK inhibitor? Should you switch? Well, if they're otherwise doing fine, remember, our goal with CLL is, I mean, obviously, I hope it someday will cure CLL. But the point is our goal is always to think about how we sequence these therapies and how do you get the most mileage out of therapies with patients with CLL, just because it is a chronic disease. And maybe with the exception of some of our older patients who may only need one therapy, our younger folks might go from one therapy to another. And so you're always thinking about sequencing. So if somebody is otherwise doing well on a particular therapy, I'm not necessarily just flopping or switching, because you're going to use up another class. If they have an intolerance, I think that's fair, right? So if somebody really isn't tolerating a drug, whatever BTK inhibitor, then you can move around. But otherwise, if they're not, I would normally, the same indications that we would think about which patients to choose for pirto would be patients who are having progressive disease, cytopenias, new lymphadenopathy, constitutional symptoms that go along with that. So I think we would still use the same indication, whether it's pirto or any other relapse treatment that you're going to think about.
What about patients who might be asymptomatic? What would be the logic in terms of switching or not switching to pirtobrutinib or whatever therapy they may still be on?
So, you know, if somebody is asymptomatic, and remember, you are going to find that some of your patients might start to progress, but they're relatively asymptomatic. So I think it depends, you know, and so this is a question that, again, when we think about strategy, we are thinking about, you know, long term. And so if somebody's, let's say, white count, so it depends on which camp they're in. So if they're currently on a BTK inhibitor and their white count is remember, that's chronic therapy, and their white count is starting to rise, they're obviously starting to develop resistance. You can send, I mean, it's more educational right now and academic. You can send for resistance testing, right? So mutational testing to C481S or another mutation. So that's sometimes important just to kind of know. Although to be fair, remember, not all patients who are having progressive disease may have a resistant, an identifiable resistant mutation. So that, you know, it's good to know. You know, we do this in the academic setting because some of you know that obviously there is some data that besides C481S, there happens to be some other resistant mutations, and some of them may be overlapping between the covalent and non-covalent BTK inhibitors. And so the question is, in the future, as these tests become more mainstream, you know, will that influence how we sequence therapies, right? So maybe you may say, ooh, this is a common mutation for both the non-covalents and the covalents. You know, I may not go from that to that. Maybe I'll switch then to, you know, a ven-based therapy, you know, so on and so forth. We don't have that kind of granularity of data yet. So it's not that we're telling people to do this because we really don't know yet, right? So those cases with some of these, you know, similar mutations that we can see with both of these agents aren't necessarily, you know, they're very infrequent and rare. And we don't know, to be fair, again, when patients went on the Bruin study, which is that pertubrutinib study in the relapse setting, it didn't impact the responses of what they did. So we really don't have a lot of data yet on this. But I think in the future, resistance mutational testing is potentially relevant and important and may influence the sequencing of our drugs. Now, if somebody, as I said, if they're on a BTK inhibitor and starting to have a white count that is progressing, sometimes you can buy some extra mileage out of the drug if they don't have cytopenias and you don't need to switch them so quickly. Otherwise, clearly, you know, if they're progressing, eventually you're going to change therapy. That could be to a ven-based therapy, or, you know, some other therapy we can talk about. If you start from a ven combination and do a time-limited approach where they come off of therapy, your options are, could you go back to therapy and retreat them? You could. It depends on the length of duration of that treatment. So let's say they got a great bang for the buck at a ven and an antibody, lasted more than 2 years. Could you rechallenge them and they tolerated the therapy well? Certainly you could rechallenge them. Can you go to a different agent? Like now, let's say this is, again, relapse and third line. Could you go to pertubrutinib? You absolutely could do that too, right? So I think you have more than one option. Again, I would still, if the patient is asymptomatic, I would still wait until you have a real indication for treat them just because their white count's going up. If they don't, their hemoglobin and platelets are okay, I think you're going to have the discussion that eventually they're going to need treatment again. But it doesn't mean that you necessarily have to, you know, just put them on therapy sooner. Remember, despite the fact that, I mean, I'm happy that we have all these targeted therapies and, you know, toxicity issues are improved compared to when we used to give chemo immunotherapy, but it's not like any of these agents don't have potential side effects, including infectious, you know, issues as well. And so, you know, there's no free lunch. So I like to say that, you know, because none of these therapies are curative, if they don't have an indication to treat yet, I would still kind of err on the side of being conservative. So I don't treat my patients just because they're starting to progress, you know, again. I think unless we prove that doing so, it meaningfully impacted their survival by doing this earlier, right? And we have some trials that are trying to address early intervention. I wouldn't do this just because they're asymptomatic.
I know liso-cel was also approved in that third line and beyond setting last year. So that adds the complication of choosing between that and pertubrutinib since they have a very, I think, an identical indication. So when you have a patient who might be eligible for both, how do you consider the two options?
Yeah, that's a great question. Obviously, we finally, a long time coming for CAR T and CLL, right? We started, you know, research on this more than a decade ago. But because of the toxicity issues and because we started getting all these other targeted therapies with far less toxicity, of course, you know, CAR T cell just kept getting relegated further down the line in the toolbox, of course. And so, you know, this, when we think about this, you know, there is no doubt we're very happy that we finally have an approval in CLL because, as I noted, unfortunately, there are many patients who, if they started their CLL journey when they were much younger, will get more than one therapy and we're already seeing patients, right, who relapse after a covalent, after ven, after perto, you know, so we do need newer therapies for our patients with CLL. And so having this approval, which was last year in March, I believe, of 2024, you know, is a good adjunct to our toolbox. However, we obviously still know that CAR T still has, you know, one of the benefits is that obviously it's a time-limited therapy in a way, right? So you think about that. So that's you know, one and done, so to speak. But there's still, you know, cytokine release syndrome and some potential neurologic toxicity. Now, thankfully, because of the fact that CAR T has been around for so long for other disease states, you know, we, you know, there's no doubt our colleagues who do CAR T cell therapy have gotten really good at tending to mitigate for some of these potential side effects. So that has improved with a lot of supportive care management and better management. So I think we're doing better from that standpoint. The problem in CLL, I think, it's unfortunately, is that, you know, on the studies such as the TRANSCEND study, which led to the approval of lysocell, you know, it was a really heavily, like many of our relapse refractory studies that we do when we look at any new agent for this disease, you know, some of these patients are, you know, on their fourth, fifth or more lines of therapy. So a really heavily pretreated group, right? So not a good risk group at all. And on the study, you know, that led to the approval, about 20% of the patients got a complete response. And for those 20%, it's durable and it's good, right? But for everybody else, it kind of falls short. And so, you know, thankfully, there one of the studies that an additional or an update to the TRANSCEND study in ASH in December of 2024 looked at obviously combining doing a BTK, you know, as part of the therapy to augment the response to CAR T for CLL patients. And that did double the response. And so there is no doubt that I think we still have a lot of work in CAR T and CLL to improve upon the response, because you want to get, it's almost really important to get a good response in CLL from CAR T cell, because then you know that it will be durable. So I think we still have some work to do. So when you choose, the question you asked about choosing between, you know, pirtobrutinib or lysocell, now that we have both that are approved, you know, the issue is we obviously still consider your patient, your comorbidities, how old the patient is. And to be frank, though, if somebody is, if they failed a covalence, they failed ven-based therapy, you are, you know, you do have to think of these other therapies. And even pirto in that setting, so right, so even all of these other therapies are going to be probably short-limited. So, you know, even from the Bruin study with pirtobrutinib, the median PFS after double refractory patients was, you know, less than 2 years. So you do know that you're going to have to think about other agents. So if I have, I'll just give you a case scenario that I do, you know, to as an example, if I have a young person that I'm thinking, you know, has failed a covalent, failed ven-based therapy, truly double refractory, I am going to get them evaluated by my, you know, my immune therapy guys who do CAR T, but I'm going to probably strategize to get their disease under better control. Because remember, I said it, CAR T will be important if you can get them into a good response. So getting their disease under better control. So oftentimes I'll say, okay, let's get them evaluated and then let's put them on pirto. And so sometimes I'll bridge even with pirto to CAR T for some of my younger, fitter patients. The good news is obviously, you know, we also have clinical trials. So there are lots of drugs and other things I might be exploring as well, you know, because we have newer agents that we're looking for. But when you're talking about truly what's just approved on market, you got these agents plus pirto plus CAR T, you have to evaluate that potential for both your patients. If I have an older, frailer patient that I don't think can go to CAR T, of course, I'm going to give them pirtobrutinib. Okay. But my younger ones, you know, I'm thinking about other therapies down the line. And so because I need to think ahead for them, because it's not going to last them. The older ones, it is a problem, right? So even if they're not going to go to CAR T, then you're thinking pirto, but then you're going to have to think about what you can do for those older ones who, where the response duration may not last as long, as I noted, but can you go back to some older therapies? You know, can you add in some antibody? You know, then you become artsy a little bit with combinations and things like that if you can't get them on a clinical trial with newer agents like BTK degraders or bispecifics or something else coming down the pike. But that's how I think about how to, when you think about pirto versus CAR T, lysocell, you know, you got to think about your patient. What's the strategies? What's the goals of treatment? Are they eligible for CAR? And so on and so forth. But I think you need to, if you're thinking about CAR as a potential, you should be doing the process simultaneously. You should try to have them evaluated and get them, you know, because they can collect the cells and freeze them if that's a potential. Because, the pirtobrutinib may only last so long, depending upon how heavily pretreated they are. So you got to consider that.
Obviously, pirtobrutinib is still relatively new to CLL space. And I know there are a lot of novel different BTK agents being investigated, degraders and all that. So how do you kind of see the treatment paradigm continuing to evolve, whether it be expanded role for pirtobrutinib in a different setting or some of these other novel agents kind of, again, shifting the paradigm?
Yeah. So I think one of the things that we're seeing now is that pirtobrutinib is, we talked about how it's approved now, but obviously there's been lots of studies that are starting to move pirto up in earlier lines of therapy. So that's one. And two is there's also a lot of clinical trials that are looking at combining pirtobrutinib that have already been reported with pirtobrutinib and venetoclax or pirtobrutinib, venetoclax and obinutuzumab, right? So the so-called doublets or triplets that are time limited. So I think you're going to see a lot more time-limited approaches with pirtobrutinib as well, similar to what we're seeing with covalent BTK and venetoclax combinations, right, that have moved up and made their way into the frontline setting, right? And so some of those have already, been put on the NCCN guidelines, right? Ibrutinib and venetoclax was approved in Europe from the GLOW study. And now we have Amplify with acalabrutinib and venetoclax plus or minus obinutuzumab, and that's now on NCCN guidelines as well. Not yet FDA approved acalaven, but made the NCCN guidelines. So, obviously you're going to see a lot more time-limited approaches, and these studies with pirtobrutinib have moved up both in second line and in front line. So I think you'll see first a lot of those clinical trials read out over the next several years. Positioning pirtobrutinib as a potential time-limited approach. How then are we going to think about, how to sequence those kind of therapies? Do you go from a covalent to ven to non-covalent, which is how it is now, to, well, what if they move up and they're time-limited? So I think, obviously we have more work to do about the potential role of sequencing and where to position pirtobrutinib either in frontline or second line potentially. And then of course you had alluded to, or I alluded to, the fact that there are newer agents that are coming about as well. And so I think you will also see some clinical trials combining these agents with some of these newer targets like a BTK degrader or even a bispecific. And so there are some clinical trials that are adding pirtobrutinib into multiple arms where they might be combining with a different agent. And so stay tuned. There's no doubt that the field of CLL is getting a little trickier. I am very grateful that we have lots of agents that we can utilize for our patients with CLL, but I think we still have to figure out what the best sequencing approach is or the best combinations. Although again, noting that there's more than one combination that we can avail ourselves to for our patients. But certainly I think that it is, the field is moving quickly, and yet we still have a lot of data gaps that we need to get for everybody. So stay tuned. I think it's really exciting. And there's no doubt that I think that pirtobrutinib is sort of shifting a little bit. So it does depend on where your patient started their journey and what prior therapies they got. And that's how where pirto might fit in, whether it be in third line currently or less so as data more emerges and patients are getting different alternative types of therapies in the front line. So stay tuned.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OnClive On Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OnClive is also on social media. On X and Blue Sky, follow us at OnClive. On Facebook, like us at OnClive, and follow our OnClive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OnClive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms, so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OnClive On Air.